British prince, the Moors and the Marcomanni could be tempted only by the profuse liberality of the usurper, who distributed among the barbarians the military and even the civil honours of Spain. The nine bands of Honorians, which may be easily traced on the establishment of the Western Empire, could not exceed the number of 5,000 men. Yet this inconsiderable force was sufficient to terminate a war which had threatened the power and safety of Constantine. The rustic army of the Theodosian family was surrounded and destroyed in the Pyrenees. Two of the brothers had the good fortune to escape by sea to Italy or the East. The other two, after an interval of suspense, were executed at Arles. And if Honorius could remain insensible of the public disgrace, he might perhaps be affected by the personal misfortunes of his generous kinsmen. Such were the feeble arms which decided the position of the western provinces of Europe, from the wall of Antoninus to the columns of Hercules. The events of peace and war have undoubtedly been diminished by the narrow and imperfect view of the historians of the times, who were equally ignorant of the causes and of the effects of the most important revolutions. But the total decay of the national strength had annihilated even the last resource of a despotic government, and the revenue of exhausted provinces could no longer purchase the military service of a discontented and pusillanimous people. The poet, whose flattery has ascribed to the Roman eagle the victories of Pollentia and Verona, pursues the hasty retreat of Valeric from the confines of Italy with a horrid train of imaginary spectres, such as might hover over an army of barbarians which was almost exterminated by war, famine, and disease. In the course of this unfortunate expedition, the king of the Goths must indeed have sustained a considerable loss, and his harassed forces required an interval of repose to recruit their numbers and revive their confidence. Adversity had exercised and displayed the genius of Alaric, and the fame of his valour invited to the Gothic standard the bravest of the barbarian warriors, who, from the Black Sea to the Rhine, were agitated by the desire of rapine and conquest. He had deserved the esteem, and he soon accepted the friendship of Stilicho himself. Renouncing the service of the Emperor of the East, Alaric concluded with the court of Ravenna a treaty of peace and alliance, by which he was declared master general of the Roman armies throughout the prefecture of Illyricum, as it was claimed, according to the true and ancient limits, by the minister of Honorius. The execution of the ambitious design, which was either stipulated or implied in the articles of the treaty, appears to have been suspended by the formidable eruption of Radagaisus, and the neutrality of the Gothic king may perhaps be compared to the indifference of Caesar, who in the conspiracy of Catiline refused either to assist or to oppose the enemy of the Republic. After the defeat of the Vandals, Stilicho resumed his pretensions to the provinces of the East, appointed civil magistrates for the administration of justice and of the finances, and declared his impatience to lead to the gates of Constantinople the united armies of the Romans and of the Goths. The prudence, however, of Stilicho, his aversion to civil war, and his perfect knowledge of the weakness of the state, may countenance the suspicion that domestic peace, rather than foreign conquest, was the object of his policy, and that his principal care was to employ the forces of Alaric at a distance from Italy. This design could not long escape the penetration of the Gothic king, who continued to hold a doubtful and perhaps a treacherous correspondence with the rival courts, who protracted, like a dissatisfied mercenary, his languid operations in Thessaly and Epirus, and who soon returned to claim the extravagant reward of his ineffectual services. From his camp near Imona, on the confines of Italy, he transmitted to the Emperor of the West a long account of promises, of expenses, and of demands, called for immediate satisfaction, and clearly intimated the consequences of a refusal. Yet if his conduct was hostile, his language was decent and dutiful. He humbly professed himself the friend of Stilicho and the soldier of Honorius, offered his person and his troops to march without delay against the usurper of Gaul, and solicited as a permanent retreat for the Gothic nation the possession of some vacant province of the Western Empire. The political and secret transactions of two statesmen who labored to deceive each other and the world must forever have been concealed in the impenetrable darkness of the cabinet, if the debates of a popular assembly had not thrown some rays of light on the correspondence of Alaric and Stilicho. The necessity of finding some artificial support for a government which, from a principle not of moderation but of weakness, was reduced to negotiate with its own subjects, had insensibly revived the authority of the Roman Senate, and the minister of Honorius respectfully consulted the legislative council of the Republic. Stilicho assembled the Senate in the palace of the Caesars, represented in a studied oration the actual state of affairs, proposed the demands of the Gothic king, and submitted to their consideration the choice of peace or war. The senators, as if they had been suddenly awakened from a dream of 400 years, appeared on this important occasion to be inspired by the courage rather than by the wisdom of their predecessors. They loudly declared in regular speeches or in tumultuary acclamations that it was unworthy of the majesty of Rome to purchase a precarious and disgraceful truce from a barbarian king, and that, in the judgment of a magnanimous people, the chance of ruin was always preferable to the certainty of dishonor. The minister, whose pacific intentions were seconded only by the voice of a few servile and venal followers, attempted to allay the general ferment by an apology for his own conduct, and even for the demands of the Gothic prince. The payment of a subsidy which had excited the indignation of the Romans ought not, such was the language of Stilicho, to be considered in the odious light either of a tribute or of a ransom extorted by the menaces of a barbarian enemy. Alaric had faithfully asserted the just pretensions of the Republic to the provinces which were usurped by the Greeks of Constantinople. He modestly required the fair and stipulated recompense of his services, and if he had desisted from the prosecution of his enterprise, he had obeyed in his retreat the peremptory, though private, letters of the emperor himself. These contradictory orders, he would not dissemble the errors of his own family, had been procured by the intercession of Serena. The tender piety of his wife had been too deeply affected by the discord of the royal brothers, the sons of her adopted father, and the sentiments of nature had too easily prevailed over the stern dictates of the public welfare. These ostensible reasons, which faintly disguised the obscure intrigues of the palace of Ravenna, were supported by the authority of Stilicho, and obtained, after a warm debate, the reluctant approbation of the Senate. The tumult of virtue and freedom subsided, and the sum of 4,000 pounds of gold was granted, under the name of a subsidy to secure the peace of Italy and to conciliate the friendship of the King of the Goths. Lampadius alone, one of the most illustrious members of the assembly, still persisted in his dissent, exclaimed with a loud voice, "This is not a treaty of peace, but of servitude," and escaped the danger of such bold opposition by immediately retiring to the sanctuary of a Christian church. But the reign of Stilicho drew towards its end, and the proud minister might perceive the symptoms of his approaching disgrace. The generous boldness of Lampadius had been applauded, and the Senate, so patiently resigned to a long servitude, rejected with disdain the offer of invidious and imaginary freedom. The troops who still assumed the name and prerogatives of the Roman legions were exasperated by the partial affection of Stilicho for the barbarians, and the people imputed to the mischievous policy of the minister the public misfortunes which were the natural consequence of their own degeneracy. Yet Stilicho might have continued to brave the clamors of the people and even of the soldiers, if he could have maintained his dominion over the feeble mind of his pupil. But the respectful attachment of Honorius was converted into fear, suspicion, and hatred. The crafty Olympius, who concealed his vices under the mask of Christian piety, had secretly undermined the benefactor by whose favour he was promoted to the honourable offices of the imperial palace. Olympius revealed to the unsuspecting emperor, who had attained the 25th year of his age, that he was without weight or authority in his own government, and artfully alarmed his timid and indolent disposition by a lively picture of the designs of Stilicho, who already meditated the death of his sovereign with the ambitious hope of placing the diadem on the head of his son, Eucherius. The emperor was instigated by his new favorite to assume the tone of independent dignity, and the minister was astonished to find that secret resolutions were formed in the court and council which were repugnant to his interest or to his intentions. Instead of residing in the palace of Rome, Honorius declared that it was his pleasure to return to the secure fortress of Ravenna. On the first intelligence of the death of his brother Arcadius, he prepared to visit Constantinople and to regulate with the authority of a guardian the provinces of the infant Theodosius. The representation of the difficulty and expenses of such a distant expedition checked this strange and sudden sally of active diligence. But the dangerous project of showing the emperor to the camp of Pavia, which was composed of the Roman troops, the enemies of Stilicho, and his barbarian auxiliaries, remained fixed and unalterable. The minister was pressed, by the advice of his confidant, Justinian, a Roman advocate of a lively and penetrating genius, to oppose a journey so prejudicial to his reputation and safety. His strenuous but ineffectual efforts confirmed the triumph of Olympius, and the prudent lawyer withdrew himself from the impending ruin of his patron. In the passage of the emperor through Bologna, a mutiny of the guards was excited and appeased by the secret policy of Stilicho, who announced his instructions to decimate the guilty, and ascribed to his own intercession the merit of their pardon. After this tumult, Honorius embraced for the last time the minister whom he now considered as a tyrant, and proceeded on his way to the camp of Pavia, where he was received by the loyal acclamations of the troops who were assembled for the service of the Gallic War. On the morning of the fourth day he pronounced, as he had been taught, a military oration in the presence of the soldiers, whom the charitable visits and artful discourses of Olympius had prepared to execute a dark and bloody conspiracy. At the first signal they massacred the friends of Stilicho, the most illustrious officers of the empire, two praetorian prefects of Gaul and of Italy, two masters general of the cavalry and infantry, the master of the offices, the quaestor, the treasurer, and the count of the domestics. Many lives were lost, many houses were plundered. The furious sedition continued to rage till the close of the evening, and the trembling emperor, who was seen in the streets of Pavia without his robes or diadem, yielded to the persuasions of his favorite, condemned the memory of the slain, and solemnly approved the innocence and fidelity of their assassins. The intelligence of the massacre of Pavia filled the mind of Stilicho with just and gloomy apprehensions, and he instantly summoned in the camp of Bologna a council of the confederate leaders who were attached to his service and would be involved in his ruin. The impetuous voice of the assembly called aloud for arms and for revenge, to march without a moment's delay under the banners of a hero whom they had so often followed to victory, to surprise, to oppress, to extirpate the guilty Olympius and his degenerate Romans, and perhaps to fix the diadem on the head of their injured general. Instead of executing a resolution which might have been justified by success, Stilicho hesitated till he was irrecoverably lost. He was still ignorant of the fate of the emperor. He distrusted the fidelity of his own party, and he viewed with horror the fatal consequences of arming a crowd of licentious barbarians against the soldiers and people of Italy. The Confederates, impatient of his timorous and doubtful delay, hastily retired with fear and indignation. At the hour of midnight, Sarus, a Gothic warrior, renowned among the barbarians themselves for his strength and valor, suddenly invaded the camp of his benefactor, plundered the baggage, cut in pieces the faithful Huns who guarded his persons, and penetrated to the tent, where the minister, pensive and sleepless, meditated on the dangers of his situation. Stilicho escaped with difficulty from the sword of the Goths, and after issuing a last and generous admonition to the cities of Italy to shut their gates against the barbarians, his confidence or his despair urged him to throw himself into Ravenna, which was already in the absolute possession of his enemies. Olympius, who had assumed the dominion of Honorius, was speedily informed that his rival had embraced as a suppliant the altar of the Christian Church. The base and cruel disposition of the hypocrite was incapable of pity or remorse, but he piously affected to elude rather than to violate the privilege of the sanctuary. Count Heraclian, with a troop of soldiers, appeared at the dawn of day before the gates of the Church of Ravenna. The bishop was satisfied by a solemn oath that the imperial mandate only directed them to secure the person of Stilicho, that as soon as the unfortunate minister had been tempted beyond the holy threshold, he produced a warrant for his instant execution. Stilicho supported with calm resignation the injurious names of traitor and parricide, repressed the unseasonable zeal of his followers, who were ready to attempt an ineffectual rescue, and with a firmness not unworthy of the last of the Roman generals, submitted his neck to the sword of Heraclian. The servile crowd of the palace, who had so long adored the fortune of Stilicho, affected to insult his fall, and the most distant connection with the Master General of the West, which had so lately been a title to wealth and honors, was studiously denied and rigorously punished. His family, united by a triple alliance with the family of Theodosius, might envy the condition of the meanest peasant. The flight of his son Eucherius was intercepted, and the death of that innocent youth soon followed the divorce of Thermantia, who filled the place of her sister Maria, and who, like Maria, had remained a virgin in the imperial bed. The friends of Stilicho, who had escaped the massacre of Pavia, were persecuted by the implacable revenge of Olympius, and the most exquisite cruelty was employed to extort the confession of a treasonable and sacrilegious conspiracy. They died in silence. Their firmness justified the choice and perhaps absolved the innocence of their patron, and the despotic power which could take his life without a trial and stigmatize his memory without a proof has no jurisdiction over the impartial suffrage of posterity. The services of Stilicho are great and manifest. His crimes, as they are vaguely stated in the language of flattery and hatred, are obscure at least and improbable. About 4 months after his death, an edict was published in the name of Honorius to restore the free communication of the two empires which had been so long interrupted by the public enemy. The minister, whose fame and fortune depended on the prosperity of the state, was accused of betraying Italy to the barbarians, whom he repeatedly vanquished at Pollentia, at Verona, and before the walls of Florence. His pretended design of placing the diadem on the head of his son, Eucherius, could not have been conducted without preparations or accomplices, and the ambitious father would not surely have left the future emperor till the 20th year of his age in the humble station of tribune of the notaries. Even the religion of Stilicho was arraigned by the malice of his rival. The seasonable and almost miraculous deliverance was devoutly celebrated by the applause of the clergy, who asserted that the restoration of idols and the persecution of the church would have been the first measure of the reign of Eucherius. The son of Stilicho, however, was educated in the bosom of Christianity, which his father had uniformly professed and zealously supported. Serena had borrowed her magnificent necklace from the statue of Vesta, and the pagans execrated the memory of the sacrilegious minister by whose order the Sibylline books, the oracles of Rome, had been committed to the flames. The pride and power of Stilicho constituted his real guilt. An honorable reluctance to shed the blood of his countrymen appears to have contributed to the success of his unworthy rival. And it is the last humiliation of the character of Honorius that posterity has not condescended to reproach him with his base ingratitude to the guardian of his youth and the support of his empire. Among the train of dependents whose wealth and dignity attracted the notice of their own times, our curiosity is excited by the celebrated name of the poet Claudian, who enjoyed the favor of Stilicho and was overwhelmed in the ruin of his patron. The titular offices of tribune and notary fixed his rank in the imperial court. He was indebted to the powerful intercession of Serena for his marriage with a very rich heiress of the province of Africa. And the statue of Claudian, erected in the Forum of Trajan, was a monument of the taste and liberality of the Roman Senate. After the praises of Stilicho became offensive and criminal, Claudian was exposed to the enmity of a powerful and unforgiving courtier, whom he had provoked by the insolence of wit. He had compared, in a lively epigram, the opposite characters of two praetorian prefects of Italy. He contrasts the innocent repose of a philosopher who sometimes resigned the hours of business to slumber, perhaps to study, with the interesting diligence of a rapacious minister, indefatigable in the pursuit of unjust or sacrilegious gain. "How happy," continues Claudian, "how happy might it be for the people of Italy if Malleus could be constantly awake, and if Hadrian would always sleep." The repose of Malleus was not disturbed by this friendly and gentle admonition, but the cruel vigilance of Hadrian watched the opportunity of revenge and easily obtained from the enemies of Stilicho the trifling sacrifice of an obnoxious poet. The poet concealed himself, however, during the tumult of the revolution, and consulting the dictates of prudence rather than of honor, he addressed in the form of an epistle a suppliant and humble recantation to the offended prefect. He deplores in mournful strains the fatal indiscretion into which he had been hurried by passion and folly, submits to the imitation of his adversary the generous examples of the clemency of gods, of heroes, and of lions, and expresses his hope that the magnanimity of Hadrian will not trample on a defenseless and contemptible foe, already humbled by disgrace and poverty, and deeply wounded by the exile, the tortures, and the death of his dearest friends. Whatever might be the success of his prayer or the accidents of his future life, the period of a few years leveled in the grave the minister and the poet. But the name of Hadrian is almost sunk in oblivion, while Claudian is read with pleasure in every country which has retained or acquired the knowledge of the Latin language. If we fairly balance his merits and his defects, we shall acknowledge that Claudian does not either satisfy or silence our reason. It would not be easy to produce a passage that deserves the epithet of sublime or pathetic, to select a verse that melts the heart or enlarges the imagination. We should vainly seek in the poems of Claudian the happy invention and artificial conduct of an interesting fable, or the just and lively representation of the characters and situations of real life. For the service of his patron he published occasional panegyrics and invectives, and the design of these slavish compositions encouraged his propensity to exceed the limits of truth and nature. These imperfections, however, are compensated in some degree by the poetical virtues of Claudian. He was endowed with the rare and precious talent of raising the meanest, of adorning the most barren, and of diversifying the most similar topics. His colouring, more especially in descriptive poetry, is soft and splendid, and he seldom fails to display and even to abuse the advantages of a cultivated understanding, a copious fancy, an easy and sometimes forcible expression, and a perpetual flow of harmonious versification. To these commendations, independent of any accidents of time and place, we must add the peculiar merit which Claudian derived from the unfavorable circumstances of his birth. In the decline of arts and of empire, a native of Egypt who had received the education of a Greek assumed in a mature age the familiar use and absolute command of the Latin language, soared above the heads of his feeble contemporaries, and placed himself, after an interval of 300 years, among the poets of ancient Rome. Chapter 31. Invasion of Italy by Alaric. Manners of the Roman Senate and People. Rome is thrice besieged and at length pillaged by the Goths. Death of Alaric. The Goths evacuate Italy. Fall of Constantine. Gaul and Spain are occupied by the barbarians. Independence of Britain. Part 1. The incapacity of a weak and distracted government may often assume the appearance and produce the effects of a treasonable correspondence with the public enemy. If Alaric himself had been introduced into the Council of Ravenna, he would probably have advised the same measures which were actually pursued by the ministers of Honorius. The king of the Goths would have conspired, perhaps with some reluctance, to destroy the formidable adversary by whose arms, in Italy as well as in Greece, he had been twice overthrown. Their active and interested hatred laboriously accomplished the disgrace and ruin of the great Stilicho. The valour of Sarus, his fame in arms, and his personal or hereditary influence over the confederate barbarians, could recommend him only to the friends of their country who despised or detested the worthless characters of Turpilio, Varanes, and Vigilantius. By the pressing instances of the new favorites, these generals, unworthy as they had shown themselves of the names of soldiers, were promoted to the command of the cavalry, of the infantry, and of the domestic troops. The Gothic prince would have subscribed with pleasure the edict which the fanaticism of Olympius dictated to the simple and devout emperor. Honorius excluded all persons who were adverse to the Catholic Church from holding any office in the state, obstinately rejected the service of all those who dissented from his religion, and rashly disqualified many of his bravest and most skillful officers who adhered to the pagan worship or who had imbibed the opinions of Arianism. These measures, so advantageous to an enemy, Alaric would have approved and might perhaps have suggested. But it may seem doubtful whether the barbarian would have promoted his interest at the expense of the inhuman and absurd cruelty which was perpetrated by the direction, or at least with the connivance of the imperial ministers. The foreign auxiliaries who had been attached to the person of Stilicho lamented his death, but the desire of revenge was checked by a natural apprehension for the safety of their wives and children, who were detained as hostages in the strong cities of Italy, where they had likewise deposited their most valuable effects. At the same hour, and as if by a common signal, the cities of Italy were polluted by the same horrid scenes of universal massacre and pillage which involved in promiscuous destruction the families and fortunes of the barbarians. Exasperated by such an injury which might have awakened the tamest and most servile spirit, they cast a look of indignation and hope towards the camp of Alaric, and unanimously swore to pursue with just and implacable war the perfidious nation who had so basely violated the laws of hospitality. By the imprudent conduct of the ministers of Honorius, the Republic lost the assistance and deserved the enmity of 30,000 of her bravest soldiers, and the weight of that formidable army, which alone might have determined the event of the war, was transferred from the scale of the Romans into that of the Goths. In the arts of negotiation, as well as in those of war, the Gothic king maintained his superior ascendant over an enemy whose seeming changes proceeded from the total want of counsel and design. From his camp on the confines of Italy, Alaric attentively observed the revolutions of the palace, watched the progress of faction and discontent, disguised the hostile aspect of a barbarian invader, and assumed the more popular appearance of the friend and ally of the great Stilicho, to whose virtues, when they were no longer formidable, he could pay a just tribute of sincere praise and regret. The pressing invitation of the malcontents who urged the king of the Goths to invade Italy was enforced by a lively sense of his personal injuries, and he might especially complain that the imperial ministers still delayed and eluded the payment of the 4,000 pounds of gold which had been granted by the Roman Senate, either to reward his services or to appease his fury. His decent firmness was supported by an artful moderation, which contributed to the success of his designs. He required a fair and reasonable satisfaction, but he gave the strongest assurances that as soon as he had obtained it, he would immediately retire. He refused to trust the faith of the Romans unless Aetius and Jason, the sons of two great officers of state, were sent as hostages to his camp. But he offered to deliver in exchange several of the noblest youths of the Gothic nation. The modesty of Alaric was interpreted by the ministers of Ravenna as a sure evidence of his weakness and fear. They disdained either to negotiate a treaty or to assemble an army, and with a rash confidence derived only from their ignorance of the extreme danger, irretrievably wasted the decisive moments of peace and war. While they expected in sullen silence that the barbarians would evacuate the confines of Italy, Alaric, with bold and rapid marches, passed the Alps and the Po, hastily pillaged the cities of Aquileia, Altinum, Concordia, and Cremona, which yielded to his arms, increased his forces by the accession of 30,000 auxiliaries, and without meeting a single enemy in the field, advanced as far as the edge of the morass which protected the impregnable residence of the Emperor of the West. Instead of attempting the hopeless siege of Ravenna, the prudent leader of the Goths proceeded to Rimini, stretched his ravages along the seacoast of the Hadriatic, and meditated the conquest of the ancient mistress of the world. An Italian hermit, whose zeal and sanctity were respected by the barbarians themselves, encountered the victorious monarch, and boldly denounced the indignation of heaven against the oppressors of the earth. But the saint himself was confounded by the solemn asseveration of Alaric that he felt a secret and preternatural impulse which directed and even compelled his march to the gates of Rome. He felt that his genius and his fortune were equal to the most arduous enterprises, and the enthusiasm which he communicated to the Goths insensibly removed the popular and almost superstitious reverence of the nations for the majesty of the Roman name. His troops, animated by the hopes of spoil, followed the course of the Flaminian Way, occupied the unguarded passes of the Apennine, descended into the rich plains of Umbria, and as they lay encamped on the banks of the Clitumnus, might wantonly slaughter and devour the milky white oxen which had been so long reserved for the use of Roman triumphs. A lofty situation and a seasonable tempest of thunder and lightning preserved the little city of Narni. But the king of the Goths, despising the ignoble prey, still advanced with unabated vigor, and after he had passed through the stately arches adorned with the spoils of barbaric victories, he pitched his camp under the walls of Rome. During a period of 619 years, the seat of empire had never been violated by the presence of a foreign enemy. The unsuccessful expedition of Hannibal served only to display the character of the Senate and people, of a Senate degraded rather than ennobled by the comparison of an assembly of kings, and of a people to whom the ambassador of Pyrrhus ascribed the inexhaustible resources of the Hydra. Each of the senators in the time of the Punic War had accomplished his term of the military service either in a subordinate or a superior station, and the decree which invested with temporary command all those who had been consuls or censors or dictators gave the Republic the immediate assistance of many brave and experienced generals. In the beginning of the war, the Roman people consisted of 250,000 citizens of an age to bear arms. 50,000 had already died in the defense of their country, and the 23 legions which were employed in the different camps of Italy, Greece, Sardinia, Sicily, and Spain required about 100,000 men. But there still remained an equal number in Rome, and the adjacent territory, who were animated by the same intrepid courage. And every citizen was trained from his earliest youth in the discipline and exercises of a soldier. Hannibal was astonished by the constancy of the Senate, who, without raising the siege of Capua or recalling their scattered forces, expected his approach. He encamped on the banks of the Anio at the distance of 3 miles from the city, and he was soon informed that the ground on which he had pitched his tent was sold for an adequate price at a public auction, and that a body of troops was dismissed by an opposite road to reinforce the legions of Spain. He led his Africans to the gates of Rome, where he found 3 armies in order of battle prepared to receive him. But Hannibal dreaded the event of a combat from which he could not hope to escape unless he destroyed the last of his enemies, and his speedy retreat confessed the invincible courage of the Romans. From the time of the Punic War, the uninterrupted succession of senators had preserved the name and image of the Republic, and the degenerate subjects of Honorius ambitiously derived their descent from the heroes who had repulsed the arms of Hannibal and subdued the nations of the earth. The temporal honors which the devout Paula inherited and despised are carefully recapitulated by Jerome, the guide of her conscience and the historian of her life. The genealogy of her father, Rogatus, which ascended as high as Agamemnon, might seem to betray a Grecian origin, but her mother, Blaesilla, numbered the Scipios, Aemilius Paulus, and the Gracchi in the list of her ancestors, and Toxotius, the husband of Paula, deduced his royal lineage from Aeneas, the father of the Julian line. The vanity of the rich who desired to be noble was gratified by these lofty pretensions. Encouraged by the applause of their parasites, they easily imposed on the credulity of the vulgar, and were countenanced in some measure by the custom of adopting the name of their patron, which had always prevailed among the freedmen and clients of illustrious families. Most of those families, however, attacked by so many causes of external violence or internal decay, were gradually extirpated, and it would be more reasonable to seek for a lineal descent of 20 generations among the mountains of the Alps or in the peaceful solitude of Apulia than on the theatre of Rome, the seat of fortune, of danger, and of perpetual revolutions. Under each successive reign, and from every province of the empire, a crowd of hardy adventurers, rising to eminence by their talents or their vices, usurped the wealth, the honors, and the palaces of Rome, and oppressed or protected the poor and humble remains of consular families who were ignorant, perhaps, of the glory of their ancestors. In the time of Jerome and Claudian, the senators unanimously yielded the preeminence to the Anician line, and a slight view of their history will serve to appreciate the rank and antiquity of the noble families which contended only for the second place. During the five first ages of the city, the name of the Anicians was unknown. They appear to have derived their origin from Praenisti, and the ambition of those new citizens was long satisfied with the plebeian honors of tribunes of the people. 168 years before the Christian era, the family was ennobled by the praetorship of Anicius, who gloriously terminated the Illyrian War by the conquest of the nation and the captivity of their king. From the triumph of that general, three consulships in distant periods mark the succession of the Anician name. From the reign of Diocletian to the final extinction of the Western Empire, that name shone with a luster which was not eclipsed in the public estimation by the majesty of the imperial purple. The several branches to whom it was communicated united, by marriage or inheritance, the wealth and titles of the Anician, the Petronian, and the Olibrian houses, and in each generation the number of consulships was multiplied by an hereditary claim. The Anician family excelled in faith and in riches. They were the first of the Roman Senate who embraced Christianity, and it is probable that Anicius Julian, who was afterwards consul and prefect of the city, atoned for his attachment to the party of Maxentius by the readiness with which he accepted the religion of Constantine. Their ample patrimony was increased by the industry of Probus, the chief of the Anician family, who shared with Gratian the honors of the consulship and exercised four times the high office of praetorian prefect. His immense estates were scattered over the wide extent of the Roman world, and though the public might suspect or disprove the methods by which they had been acquired, the generosity and magnificence of that fortunate statesman deserved the gratitude of his clients and the admiration of strangers. Such was the respect entertained for his memory that the two sons of Probus in their earliest youth, and at the request of the Senate, were associated in the consular dignity, a memorable distinction without example in the annals of Rome. Part 2. The marbles of the Anician palace were used as a proverbial expression of opulence and splendor. But the nobles and senators of Rome aspired in due gradation to imitate that illustrious family. The accurate description of the city, which was composed in the Theodosian age, enumerates 1,780 houses, the residence of wealthy and honorable citizens. Many of these stately mansions might almost excuse the exaggeration of the poet that Rome contained a multitude of palaces, and that each palace was equal to a city, since it included within its own precincts everything which could be subservient either to use or luxury: markets, hippodromes, temples, fountains, baths, porticos, shady groves, and artificial aviaries. The historian Olympiodorus, who represents the state of Rome when it was besieged by the Goths, continues to observe that several of the richest senators received from their estates an annual income of 4,000 pounds of gold, above 160,000 pounds sterling, without computing the stated provision of corn and wine, which, had they been sold, might have equaled in value one-third of the money. Compared to this immoderate wealth, an ordinary revenue of 1,000 or 1,500 pounds of gold might be considered as no more than adequate to the dignity of the senatorian rank, which required many expenses of a public and ostentatious kind. Several examples are recorded in the age of Honorius of vain and popular nobles who celebrated the year of their praetorship by a festival which lasted 7 days and cost above 100,000 pounds sterling. The estates of the Roman senators, which so far exceeded the proportion of modern wealth, were not confined to the limits of Italy. Their possessions extended far beyond the Ionian and Aegean seas to the most distant provinces. The city of Nicopolis, which Augustus had founded as an eternal monument of the Actian victory, was the property of the devout Paula. And it is observed by Seneca that the rivers which had divided hostile nations now flowed through the lands of private citizens. According to their temper and circumstances, the estates of the Romans were either cultivated by the labour of their slaves, or granted for a certain and stipulated rent to the industrious farmer. The economical writers of antiquity strenuously recommend the former method, wherever it may be practicable. But if the object should be removed by its distance or magnitude from the immediate eye of the master, they prefer the active care of an old hereditary tenant, attached to the soil and interested in the produce, to the mercenary administration of a negligent, perhaps an unfaithful, steward. The opulent nobles of an immense capital, who were never excited by the pursuit of military glory, and seldom engaged in the occupations of civil government, naturally resigned their leisure to the business and amusements of private life. At Rome, commerce was always held in contempt, but the senators, from the first age of the Republic, increased their patrimony and multiplied their clients by the lucrative practice of usury, and the obsolete laws were eluded or violated by the mutual inclinations and interest of both parties. A considerable mass of treasure must always have existed at Rome, either in the current coin of the empire or in the form of gold and silver plate. And there were many sideboards in the time of Pliny, which contained more solid silver than had been transported by Scipio from vanquished Carthage. The greater part of the nobles who dissipated their fortunes in profuse luxury found themselves poor in the midst of wealth and idle in a constant round of dissipation. Their desires were continually gratified by the labour of a thousand hands, of the numerous train of their domestic slaves, who were actuated by the fear of punishment, and of the various professions of artificers and merchants, who were more powerfully impelled by the hopes of gain. The ancients were destitute of many of the conveniences of life, which have been invented or improved by the progress of industry, and the plenty of glass and linen has diffused more real comforts among the modern nations of Europe than the senators of Rome could derive from all the refinements of pompous or sensual luxury. Their luxury and their manners have been the subject of minute and laborious disposition. But as such inquiries would divert me too long from the design of the present work, I shall produce an authentic state of Rome and its inhabitants, which is more peculiarly applicable to the period of the Gothic invasion. Ammianus Marcellinus, who prudently chose the capital of the empire as the residence the best adapted to the historian of his own times, has mixed with the narrative of public events a lively representation of the scenes with which he was familiarly conversant. The judicious reader will not always approve of the asperity of censure, the choice of circumstances, or the style of expression. He will, perhaps, detect the latent prejudices and personal resentments which soured the temper of Ammianus himself, but he will surely observe with philosophic curiosity the interesting and original picture of the manners of Rome. The greatness of Rome, such is the language of the historian, was founded on the rare and almost incredible alliance of virtue and of fortune. The long period of her infancy was employed in a laborious struggle against the tribes of Italy, the neighbors and enemies of the rising city. In the strength and ardor of youth, she sustained the storms of war, carried her victorious arms beyond the seas and the mountains, and brought home triumphal laurels from every country of the globe. At length, verging towards old age and sometimes conquering by the terror only of her name, she sought the blessings of ease and tranquillity. The venerable city, which had trampled on the necks of the fiercest nations and established a system of laws, the perpetual guardians of justice and freedom, was content, like a wise and wealthy parent, to devolve on the Caesars, her favorite sons, the care of governing her ample patrimony. A secure and profound peace, such as had been once enjoyed in the reign of Numa, succeeded to the tumults of a republic. While Rome was still adored as the queen of the earth, and the subject nations still reverenced the name of the people and the majesty of the Senate. but this native splendor, continues Ammianus, is degraded and sullied by the conduct of some nobles who, unmindful of their own dignity and of that of their country, assume an unbounded license of vice and folly. They contend with each other in the empty vanity of titles and surnames, and curiously select or invent the most lofty and sonorous appellations, Reborus, or Fabunius, Pagonius, or Tiresias, which may impress the ears of the vulgar with astonishment and respect. From a vain ambition of perpetuating their memory, they affect to multiply their likeness in statues of bronze and marble, nor are they satisfied unless those statues are covered with plates of gold, an honorable distinction first granted to Achilles, the consul, after he had subdued by his arms and counsels the power of King Antiochus. The ostentation of displaying, of magnifying, perhaps, the rent-roll of the estates which they possess in all the provinces, from the rising to the setting sun, provokes the just resentment of every man who recollects that their poor and invincible ancestors were not distinguished from the meanest of the soldiers by the delicacy of their food or the splendor of their apparel. But the modern nobles measure their rank and consequence according to the loftiness of their chariots and the weighty magnificence of their dress. Their long robes of silk and purple float in the wind, and as they are agitated by art or accident, they occasionally discover the undergarments, the rich tunics embroidered with the figures of various animals, followed by a train of 50 servants, and tearing up the pavement, they move along the streets with the same impetuous speed as if they travelled with post-horses, and the example of the senators is boldly imitated by the matrons and ladies, whose covered carriages are continually driving round the immense space of the city and suburbs. Whenever these persons of high distinction condescend to visit the public baths, they assume, on their entrance, a tone of loud and insolent command, and appropriate to their own use the conveniences which were designed for the Roman people. If in these places of mixed and general resort they meet any of the infamous ministers of their pleasures, they express their affection by tender embrace, while they proudly decline the salutations of their fellow citizens, who are not permitted to aspire above the honor of kissing their hands or their knees. As soon as they have indulged themselves in the refreshments of the bath, they resume their rings and the other ensigns of their dignity, select from their private wardrobe of the finest linen such as might suffice for a dozen persons, the garments the most agreeable to their fancy, and maintain till their departure the same haughty demeanour which perhaps might have been excused in the great Marcellus after the conquest of Syracuse. Sometimes, indeed, these heroes undertake more arduous achievements. They visit their estates in Italy, and procure themselves by the toil of servile hands the amusements of the chase. If at any time, but more especially on a hot day, they have courage to sail in their painted galleys from the Lucrine Lake to their elegant villas on the seacoast of Puteoli and Caieta, they compare their own expeditions to the marches of Caesar and Alexander. Yet should a fly presume to settle on the silken folds of their gilded umbrellas, should a sunbeam penetrate through some unguarded and imperceptible chink, they deplore their intolerable hardships and lament in affected language that they were not born in the land of the Sumerians, the regions of eternal darkness. In these journeys into the country, the whole body of the household marches with their master. In the same manner as the cavalry and infantry, the heavy and the light-armed troops, the advanced guard and the rear are marshalled by the skill of their military leaders. So the domestic officers, who bear a rod as an ensign of authority, distribute and arrange the numerous train of slaves and attendants. The baggage and wardrobe move in the front, and are immediately followed by a multitude of cooks and inferior ministers employed in the service of the kitchens and of the table. The main body is composed of a promiscuous crowd of slaves, increased by the accidental concourse of idle or dependent plebeians. The rear is closed by the favourite band of eunuchs, distributed from age to youth according to the order of seniority. Their numbers and their deformity excite the horror of the indignant spectators, who are ready to execrate the memory of Semiramis for the cruel art which she invented of frustrating the purposes of nature and of blasting in the bud the hopes of future generations. In the exercise of domestic jurisdiction, the nobles of Rome express an exquisite sensibility for any personal injury and a contemptuous indifference for the rest of the human species. When they have called for warm water, if a slave has been tardy in his obedience, he is instantly chastised with 300 lashes. But should the same slave commit a willful murder, the master will mildly observe that he is a worthless fellow, but that if he repeats the offence, he shall not escape punishment. Hospitality was formerly the virtue of the Romans, and every stranger who could plead either merit or misfortune was relieved or rewarded by their generosity. At present, if a foreigner, perhaps of no contemptible rank, is introduced to one of the proud and wealthy senators, he is welcomed, indeed, in the first audience with such warm professions and such kind inquiries that he retires, enchanted with the affability of his illustrious friend, and full of regret that he had so long delayed his journey to Rome, the active seat of manners as well as of empire. Secure of a favourable reception, he repeats his visit the ensuing day, and is mortified by the discovery that his person, his name, and his country are already forgotten. If he still has resolution to persevere, he is gradually numbered in the train of dependents and obtains the permission to pay his assiduous and unprofitable court to a haughty patron, incapable of gratitude or friendship, who scarcely deigns to remark his presence, his departure, or his return. Whenever the rich prepare a solemn and popular entertainment, whenever they celebrate with profuse and pernicious luxury their private banquets, the choice of the guests is the subject of anxious deliberation. The modest, the sober, and the learned are seldom preferred, and the nomenclators, who are commonly swayed by interested motives, have the address to insert in the list of invitations the obscure names of the most worthless of mankind. But the frequent and familiar companions of the great are those parasites who practice the most useful of all arts, the art of flattery, who eagerly applaud each word and every action of their immortal patron, gaze with rapture on his marble columns and variegated pavements, and strenuously praise the pomp and elegance which he is taught to consider as a part of his personal merit. At the Roman tables, the birds, the squirrels, or the fish, which appear of an uncommon size, are contemplated with curious attention. A pair of scales is accurately applied to ascertain their real weight, and while the more rational guests are disgusted by the vain and tedious repetition, notaries are summoned to attest by an authentic record the truth of such a marvelous event. Another method of introduction into the houses and society of the great is derived from the profession of gaming, or, as it is more politely styled, of play. The confederates are united by a strict and indissoluble bond of friendship, or rather of conspiracy. A superior degree of skill in the Tesserarian art, which may be interpreted the game of dice and tables, is a sure road to wealth and reputation. A master of that sublime science who, in a supper or assembly, is placed below a magistrate, displays in his countenance the surprise and indignation which Cato might be supposed to feel when he was refused the praetorship by the votes of a capricious people. The acquisition of knowledge seldom engages the curiosity of nobles, who abhor the fatigue and disdain the advantages of study, and the only books which they peruse are the satires of Juvenal, and the verbose and fabulous histories of Marius Maximus. The libraries which they have inherited from their fathers are secluded, like dreary sepulchres from the light of day. But the costly instruments of the theatre, flutes and enormous lyres and hydraulic organs, are constructed for their use, and the harmony of vocal and instrumental music is incessantly repeated in the palaces of Rome. In those palaces, sound is preferred to sense, and the care of the body to that of the mind. It is allowed as a salutary maxim that the light and frivolous suspicion of a contagious malady is of sufficient weight to excuse the visits of the most intimate friends, and even the servants, who are dispatched to make the decent inquiries, are not suffered to return home till they have undergone the ceremony of a previous ablution. Yet this selfish and unmanly delicacy occasionally yields to the more imperious passion of avarice. The prospect of gain will urge a rich and gouty senator as far as Spoleto. Every sentiment of arrogance and dignity is subdued by the hopes of an inheritance or even of a legacy, and a wealthy childless citizen is the most powerful of the Romans. The art of obtaining the signature of a favorable testament, and sometimes of hastening the moment of its execution, is perfectly understood, and it has happened that in the same house, though in different apartments, a husband and a wife, with the laudable design of overreaching each other, have summoned their respective lawyers to declare, at the same time, their mutual but contradictory intentions. The distress which follows and chastises extravagant luxury often reduces the great to the use of the most humiliating expedients. When they desire to borrow, they employ the base and supplicating style of the slave in the comedy. But when they are called upon to pay, they assume the royal and tragic declamation of the grandsons of Hercules. If the demand is repeated, they readily procure some trusty sycophant, instructed to maintain a charge of poison or magic against the insolent creditor, who is seldom released from prison till he has signed a discharge of the whole debt. These vices, which degrade the moral character of the Romans, are mixed with a puerile superstition that disgraces their understanding. They listen with confidence to the prediction of haruspices, who pretend to read in the entrails of victims the signs of future greatness and prosperity. And there are many who do not presume either to bathe, or to dine, or to appear in public, till they have diligently consulted, according to the rules of astrology, the situation of Mercury, and the aspect of the moon. It is singular enough that this vain credulity may often be discovered among the profane skeptics, who impiously doubt or deny the existence of a celestial power. Part 3. In populous cities, which are the seat of commerce and manufactures, the middle ranks of inhabitants who derive their subsistence from the dexterity or labor of their hands are commonly the most prolific, the most useful, and in that sense the most respectable part of the community. But the plebeians of Rome, who disdained such sedentary and servile arts, had been oppressed from the earliest times by the weight of debt and usury, and the husbandman, during the term of his military service, was obliged to abandon the cultivation of his farm. The lands of Italy, which had been originally divided among the families of free and indigent proprietors, were insensibly purchased or usurped by the avarice of the nobles. And in the age which preceded the fall of the Republic, it was computed that only 2,000 citizens were possessed of an independent substance. Yet as long as the people bestowed by their suffrages the honors of the state, the command of the legions, and the administration of wealthy provinces, their conscious pride alleviated in some measure the hardships of poverty, and their wants were seasonably supplied by the ambitious liberality of the candidates, who aspired to secure a venal majority in the 35 tribes, or the 193 centuries of Rome. But when the prodigal commons had not only imprudently alienated not only the use, but the inheritance of power, they sunk, under the reign of the Caesars, into a vile and wretched populace, which must in a few generations have been totally extinguished, if it had not been continually recruited by the manumission of slaves and the influx of strangers. As early as the time of Hadrian, it was the just complaint of the ingenuous slaves that the capital had attracted the vices of the universe and the manners of the most opposite nations. The intemperance of the Gauls, the cunning and levity of the Greeks, the savage obstinacy of the Egyptians and Jews, the servile temper of the Asiatics, and the dissolute, effeminate prostitution of the Syrians were mingled in the various multitude which, under the proud and false denomination of Romans, presumed to despise their fellow subjects and even their sovereigns, who dwelt beyond the precincts of the eternal city. Yet the name of that city was still pronounced with respect. The frequent and capricious tumults of its inhabitants were indulged with impunity, and the successors of Constantine, instead of crushing the last remains of the democracy by the strong arm of military power, embraced the mild policy of Augustus and studied to relieve the poverty and to amuse the idleness of an innumerable people. 1. For the convenience of the lazy plebeians, the monthly distributions of corn were converted into a daily allowance of bread. A great number of ovens were constructed and maintained at the public expense, and at the appointed hour each citizen, who was furnished with a ticket, ascended the flight of steps which had been assigned to his peculiar quarter or division, and received, either as a gift or at a very low price, a loaf of bread of the weight of 3 pounds for the use of his family. 2. The forest of Lucania, whose acorns fattened large droves of wild hogs, afforded as a species of tribute a plentiful supply of cheap and wholesome meat. During 5 months of the year, a regular allowance of bacon was distributed to the poorer citizens, and the annual consumption of the capital, at a time when it was much declined from its former lustre, was ascertained by an edict from Valentinian III at 3,628,000 pounds. 3. In the manners of antiquity, the use of oil was indispensable for the lamp, as well as for the bath, and the annual tax, which was imposed on Africa for the benefit of Rome, amounted to the weight of 3 millions of pounds, to the measure, perhaps, of 300,000 English gallons. 4. The anxiety of Augustus to provide the metropolis with sufficient plenty of corn was not extended beyond that necessary article of human subsistence, and when the popular clamour accused the dearness and scarcity of wine, a proclamation was issued by the grave reformer to remind his subjects that no man could reasonably complain of thirst, since the aqueducts of Agrippa had introduced into the city so many copious streams of pure and salubrious water. This rigid sobriety was insensibly relaxed, and although the generous design of Aurelian does not appear to have been executed in its full extent, the use of wine was allowed on very easy and liberal terms. The administration of the public cellars was delegated to a magistrate of honourable rank, and a considerable part of the vintage of Campania was reserved for the fortunate inhabitants of Rome. The stupendous aqueducts, so justly celebrated by the praises of Augustus himself, replenished the therm, or baths, which had been constructed in every part of the city with imperial magnificence. The baths of Antoninus Caracalla, which were open at stated hours for the indiscriminate service of the Senate